Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Glad you're listening to NPR News this morning. This hour, restaurants, trucking firms, manufacturers, hotels, construction sites, help wanted signs are up in all of these places and more, even in a moment when millions of Americans are unemployed. You'll hear some business owners and some politicians blame that on generous unemployment benefits. People don't want to work, they'll say, when they can bring in more cash on unemployment. But the story is much more complicated than that. Here's ZipRecruiter labor economist Julia Pollack to NPR recently. There's this huge gap between the kind of conditions under which people are prepared to work and the kinds of conditions that they actually find in the jobs that are available. So what does the mismatch of open jobs and willing workers mean for our economy? What does it mean for employees who are looking for the right job? What does it mean for employers who are being affected by the fact that they're struggling to find enough people to work? Our guests are going to join us in a moment. I wonder where your experience with this fits in. If you left your job or got laid off during the pandemic, how are you feeling about the opportunities that are out there right now? Are companies being flexible enough? Are they paying enough? And if you're a company owner or you recruit workers for your company, are you finding the right people with the right skills? How is this affecting your experience at your work? So I want to hear from as many people as we can get into the conversation this morning. If you're looking for work, maybe you got laid off, maybe you quit your job during the pandemic. What does the job market look like for you? And how about company owners or recruiters looking for workers? What are you finding when you try to bring in new employees? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Get in on the conversation via Twitter, tweet in at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Erica Groshen is with us, Senior Economics Advisor at Cornell's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. And with us today from Great Neck, New York, Professor Groshen, welcome. It's good to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, nice to have you on the show. Indy Dutta Gupta is the co-executive director of the Center on Poverty and Inequality at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. And Professor Gupta, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to join you, Carrie.
Professor, I want to come right back to what that labor economist for ZipRecruiter said. It's not that people won't work. It's that workers are looking for the right conditions, and I assume by conditions we also mean pay. So, Professor Gupta, how do you interpret that given a lot of the rhetoric that we're hearing about why it is that employers are struggling to find employees?
Yeah, that's a great observation. And, I think overall there are three key points that help us understand what's happening as workers in some cases may be slower to return to employment than employers certainly would like. And the basic points in my estimation are that overall unemployment benefits certainly aren't holding back the recovery, in part because they actually help stimulate demand. And a lot of people don't appreciate, but most states require a work search. And there's evidence that people actually search more intensely for work when they're receiving unemployment benefits and otherwise. And then secondly, that on balance, what we're seeing is an economic recovery that will take some time. Employers and workers both face challenges that require far more than unflipping a switch to resolve. And then finally, there are a number of longstanding challenges really that have been amplified, like unmet caregiving needs, but also the fact that there were huge holes to come out of in wages in certain sectors like leisure and hospitality. And, you know, many workers are giving a second look at those jobs and careers.
Professor Groshen, this show is about putting some facts and economic expertise, that's you two, up against a rhetoric that says, I mean, you hear this everywhere. I was arguing with my husband about this the other day. Well, people are making so much money on unemployment benefits, they just won't get up off the couch. And I say, boy, when you really dig into the numbers, it is nowhere near as simple as that. So I'd like you to come at this conventional wisdom that I don't think has a whole lot of wisdom attached to it. But what do you say?
Thank you. I want to mention one other thing just about myself so people understand where I'm coming from. From 2013 to 2017, I was the commissioner of the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. So I was I had the honor of being in charge of the incredibly dedicated group of national statisticians who are out there trying to measure things like the labor market on a regular basis. And one thing that you realize when you're doing something like being at the BLS is really how large and complicated the labor market is. It is the largest and most complicated market in the country. It is really the key to the dynamism that our country displays, mm-hmm. but also you can see the effect of problems very clearly through the labor market. So let's think about, you know, the basic question of is this sort of slowness that we're seeing being driven only by the, unemployment insurance benefits? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing you can look at is that the last three recessions before this had periods that people called the jobless recoveries, long slogs after things started to turn around before we got back to levels of employment that we had before. So it's naive to think that just because the pandemic, and pandemic isn't over yet anyway, but it's naive to think that somehow we were going to be able to flip a switch, as Professor Gupta mentioned, you know, and just all of a sudden rebound completely. When that's not at all what we've done for the past three recessions. So what are some of the reasons? Well, one, of course, you know, there are supply reasons and there are demand reasons, and then there are demand and supply reasons, right? So on the supply side, you have the child care issues that we've talked about, and those are certainly exacerbated by the pandemic, right? And it's not just mothers. It can be fathers. It can be extended family members who need to be making sure that children are cared for, right? It can be older siblings, too. You have care for disabled and elderly loved ones, very similar situation. You still have a lot of people who are probably limited by risk of getting sick because vaccination rates are still well below herd immunity.
Let me do this. I wanted to go through those different, you know, reasons mm-hmm. individually and then put some numbers and information up against that. So why don't we do that? Why don't we... we'll take this one by one and we'll both talk about it, and then we'll invite some listeners into the conversation. By the way, if you've just tuned in, a discussion here about how to understand the employment market. As Erica Groshen just told us, it is highly complicated. And the rhetoric that, boy, you hear everywhere, well, employers can't find people to work because they're sitting on the couch because they're making a lot of money in unemployment benefits, is simple and doesn't apply to the complexity of the market. So we're going to talk about some of these individual reasons why this economy is going to be slow, as our guests say, and why, as they've both added, you can't just flip a switch and it's all back to work. I want to know how this affects your own life and your own experience. If you got laid off during the pandemic or you quit, how are you feeling about the opportunities that are out there right now? Are companies paying enough? Are they being flexible enough for what you need? And employers, are you finding the right people? Are you finding enough people? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. To Lisa in Minneapolis. Hi, Lisa.
Hey, how are you, Carrie?
Doing well. Glad you called. What's your view on this?
So, you know, I have friends who have told me that they didn't realize how much money they could save if they weren't working. You know, in terms of whether it was paying for takeout food because they didn't have time to cook at home, mm-hmm. childcare we've talked about, but also things like stress of the worry of having your kids parented by somebody else if you can afford childcare, or just lots more downtime, alone time with your kids, not having your supervision. Mm-hmm. And I think trying to get people back to work and looking at the numbers during the summer is a really bad timing situation, because that's when parents are worried the most about their kids being unsupervised. So I think probably in the fall we'll have a better sense of the numbers. But
family concerns, yeah.
Yeah, and the pandemic just, you know, in an unplanned way, had all of us thinking about our quality of life. And I've gone back to work. I was unemployed for a long time, moving here to Minnesota, but I've gone back to work, but only part-time and in a position that is not my career.
Interesting.
In large part because I wanted to be available for elderly parents, mm-hmm. who might need help. So there's a lot of things going on, and I would assume that more of it is based on us having a better understanding of quality of life issues.
I appreciate the you know, your view on this, and this kind of leads to what I wanted to break down here. Professor Gupta, let's talk about what Professor Groshen brought up and what Lisa is talking about here, an understanding of how our families and our ideas of what our families need are different coming out of the pandemic. And let's just talk about childcare. How is that affecting the decisions that men and women are making about the jobs they can work and when to go back to those jobs?
Yeah, these are absolutely some of the, I think, main considerations of workers. If you think about childcare alone, of course, school has to be central to that conversation during the pandemic, since K through 12 schools, especially for, you know, elementary and middle school kids, was also providing essential child care, and continues to. I do think that there is evidence that some workers cut back on hours or are saying, hey, I can't go back to a certain type of work, say in leisure or hospitality, retail, because you have unpredictable schedules and schedules that just simply don't align with the school day or the availability of childcare. You know, the truth is childcare itself is by and large available during traditional work hours, and even then often for less than a full work day. Mm-hmm. And there are parts of the country where you can't even access that. So I think we often see when people are involuntarily experiencing unemployment that people take stock of their needs. And one of the other things that we might talk about at some point is there's been a boom in entrepreneurship too.
I think
a lot of people, you know, might have said, well, look, I wouldn't have quit my job to start a new business, but since I'm already unemployed, maybe I should take a chance on that idea I had. And in other countries, the unemployment benefit systems actually support a lot of that, and there's good evidence that that can be beneficial for all of us.
Elise says on Twitter, last year I switched to a full-time warehouse job when I closed my bodywork practice in March. I didn't take unemployment when I closed my business because I could pick up hours at a fun entry skill job, even if it was minimum wage. Then when I became terribly unhappy because I wouldn't work my trade, I quit as soon as the Minnesota Department of Health said we could. But my clientele wasn't ready to come back. I was denied eligibility when applied for unemployment because I quit a substantial job. To the phones to Roger in Minneapolis. Roger, it sounds like your family is wrestling with this in some ways. Tell me about it.
Well, yeah, I lost my job back in July of last year, and we haven't I haven't gone back to work for two reasons. One, we've been reluctant to put our children back in childcare. I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old for fear that we've been so good for the last 12 months of making sure they don't get sick. It'd be a shame to get them sick now.
Right.
And two, because it makes it very difficult when looking for a job. I've had a few interviews and I've had to say, okay, well, I need to be able to be very flexible with my hours because if our childcare has to close down for 2 weeks due to a COVID case, I need to be available to stay home and work with my kids. So that's made everything very difficult.
What happens, Roger? I can hear the kids. What happens, Roger, when you tell a potential employer that I need this kind of flexibility? I'm interested in the work, but this is kind of the deal.
They say, oh, we're trying to be very accommodating for all of our new hires and our existing employees. And I believe they probably are. But when presented with two candidates, one of which needs no availability, flexibility, and one who comes right out and says that, they're probably going to have that in the back of their mind saying, that's not somebody that we're interested in moving forward with. So I have not heard back about any of the positions where I've told somebody that.
Yeah. I'm glad for the call, Roger. Glad you were listening. Professor Groshen, what about that? I mean, employers saying, we get it. It's the pandemic. We're still in it. We're still dealing with the consequences of it. And yet kind of going back to business as usual in the way they want their employees to work.
Yeah, I think this is just when you're in a time of flux, you're going to have people, some employers going that direction and others experimenting with new ways of organizing things. And so it's not going to be, it's going to take some time for the dust to settle for experiments to prove that they work or don't work. And until that time, the employees and the employers too are going to be in this uncertain state, and you can expect that all that uncertainty is going to hold back progress towards the full recovery. So I think this is another demonstration of the costs of the uncertainty raised by the pandemic, and those are just not going to dissipate overnight.
Professor Groshen, do you feel like the 1.5 million women who have school-aged kids who dropped out of the labor force between February of 20 and March of 2021 are interested in getting back into the job market yet? I mean, they were dealing with remote schooling and childcare and other pandemic responsibilities. Are they hesitating still? I mean, kind of for the reasons that Roger suggested here.
Yes, I think they are. There are surveys that talk about, that ask those questions being asked both by the BLS and also by the Census Bureau, and they show a lot of people who are hesitating to re-enter. But there are some other reasons too. There are still cuts in mass transit, which interfere with some people being able to get back to work. And we can't forget that a lot of people actually had COVID, and some of them have long-term
right.
consequences on their health and their stamina from that. So,
right.
So certainly those are factors. And when you and children of parents, women with working age children, could have either of those factors affecting their decisions as well.
Karen called us from St. Paul. I think she had to go do her thing. She says, I'm in the retail industry. There's been a huge amount of full-time jobs that have been downgraded to part-time jobs. So people don't make enough with part-time hours, and healthcare is expensive here, and losing full-time. Ah, maybe Karen's back. Karen, I'm sorry I'm reading what you said, but let me get you on the phone line. Hi.
Hi.
Hey, so you're in the retail business, is that right?
Yes, I am. I've been in retail, Carrie, for 15 years full-time. And I hear a lot of talk about people thinking that people don't want to go back to work, but what they're not understanding is that there were a lot of full-time retail jobs that were laid off during this period, and a lot of the full-time people lost their jobs and got downgraded to part-time. And now they need that gap unemployment in order to survive. They also lost their health care benefits, which I know people that have received Minnesota Care or been able to purchase it through the marketplace, but it's very expensive. So if they pick up two part-time jobs, they're priced out of the health care marketplace. So right. It's a very sticky situation. Unfortunately, they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. They need the gap unemployment. And they're trying to get full-time jobs, but unfortunately, there's very few full-time jobs in retail right now.
So really good to have your insight on that, Karen. So Professor Gupta, I hear Karen on before the pandemic, you know, I could make a living wage and I had some benefits with this retail job. Afterwards, I can't make it on a part-time gig. I wonder, is that going to change as the economy continues to heal? Or what might we be looking at this for some time to come?
Well, that's a great question. What we do know right now is that sectors like leisure and hospitality and some retail sectors are experiencing employers competing really for the first time in a long time for workers. My own view is that we should generally be pleased by that. And that these jobs are typically compensated or offer little financial security, as Karen indicated, or opportunity for advancement. But the striking thing is we've actually seen more employment growth in those sectors than others.
Huh.
So, in fact, I think those sectors will take steps they might be reluctant to. We have almost a generation of employers who's don't want to commit to wage increases. You see a lot of bonuses and payments for showing up for interviews, but really only to some extent in leisure and hospitality are we seeing increased earnings, although some of that appears to be from tipping customers returning too in person. So it's not totally clear even what's happening there.
Another question about this, Professor Gupta, that you hear in the rhetoric that people are hanging around taking benefits and don't want to work. I'm hearing some employers say, we've got job openings, people call in to book an interview, and they do that because they want to be able to show the unemployment bureau that they are actually pursuing a job, but then they don't show. And I am reading a number of accounts from employers who are saying, you know, we can't even get through to the first or second interview phase here. What could that be about?
Well, again, most states have work search requirements as
right.
part of their unemployment insurance systems, and they require people to accept suitable work. So employers in those situations actually are empowered to potentially indicate to the State Department of Labor that someone, didn't continue. And then that person can explain why. It could be that it wasn't suitable work. And I think a lot of workers learn from interviews and find that the job opportunities may not be safe or compatible with their other responsibilities in life, as we heard earlier from some of the callers. But again, it's not the case that you just sort of get a check and all you have to do is say you applied for a job here or there. You have to keep the Department of Labor updated on what's happening with that job surge, and employers can do the same on their end.
Call from Jonathan in Coon Rapids. Jonathan, it sounds like you are doing some hiring for your company. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I work for one of the major companies here in Minneapolis, more specifically in the tech sector.
Uh-huh.
And it's been interesting that it's not that people aren't applying. It just seems like the people that are applying aren't as qualified for the positions that we're putting out there. So this is maybe a little bit more pessimistic approach to this problem, but it's a thing of where the people that were qualified, they either got rehired right away or maybe their employer doubled down. But it just seems like the individuals that are in at least the tech industry, they just aren't as qualified.
Jonathan, I'm curious about whether there's been a conversation in the company that if we want more qualified employees to apply, we might have to raise our salaries.
Oh, definitely, yes. And, certainly from the, contracting business, that has definitely been the case. If you're going through a contracting company to find a highly qualified candidate, our prices have, increased dramatically in that area. And so we've had to bite the bullet there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Really good to have your insight and your call. Thank you much. We're going to get a look at the latest news. I want to leave you with this because I want to talk about pay, especially after what Jonathan has said here. I saw this observation from Economic Policy Institute economist Heidi Shierholz. She says, I often suggest that whenever anyone says, I can't find the workers I need, she should really add, at the wages I want to pay. So how is salary and how is hourly wage affecting what employers are experiencing here? What do our guests have to say about that? Indy Dutta Gupta is the co-executive director of the Center on Poverty and Inequality at Georgetown. And Erica Groshen is senior economics advisor at the Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations. What do you have to say about that? Are you out there looking for work? Are you looking to change jobs or looking to find a new job? What do the salaries and the hourly wages look like to you? Do you think companies have gotten the message that they may need to raise the pay to get the kind of people that they want? Back to our conversation now with our guests, and let me go right to the phones here to Wendy in Minnetonka. Hi, Wendy. How's this affecting your own experience? Are you out looking for work, or what are you seeing?
Well, I was in the entertainment industry, so our work got erased in one day.
Right.
Because many of us are older, the year off, I think, made us think about retiring. And I think that we should look at the demographics of that, because I'm in the baby boomer generation. Maybe more people are retiring that were in the workforce mm-hmm. now that they've had a chance to be off.
We're close enough, you're thinking, Wendy, to retirement age. You just said, well, I guess I'm going to call it because getting back into this job market is going to be tough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Professor Groshen, what do you think of that? Is that affecting the way the job market is today?
Oh, yeah. You can see that the one part of the labor force where participation had been growing over the past 20, 30 years or even longer was workers over 65. And during the pandemic, this was a group where labor force participation has fallen dramatically and hasn't recovered nearly as much with other people. So we've really seen a reversal of that pattern. And some of that, of course, is on the supply side. People who were close to retirement just saying, well, I'm just going to, why go back?
Mm-hmm.
Some of it, I'm sure, is fear of the pandemic itself. But also there's a demand side aspect of it. And I know because my husband was one of these people, he was offered a buyout that was recession, that was pandemic induced from the university where he was teaching.
Uh-huh.
And he was going to retire pretty soon anyway, so might as well take the buyout. And we don't have data on how many buyouts like that were offered, but that was certainly, you know, a choice of the employer to say, okay, one of the ways we're going to adjust is to offer a buyout to our more senior workers.
Just kind of accelerated your plans, it sounds like.
Absolutely. We are moving to Seattle this summer.
Really? Well,
that's where the, that's
good
where
luck
the granddaughter
with that.
Is.
Oh, that's great. That's great news. Here's Dawn who says, I've never experienced such a hard time hiring teachers for the upcoming school year as I'm having this summer. Can't really increase what I can pay them unless the state increases aid to schools. We heard from Kenny in Sandstone who says, I have not been able to get a single person to apply. We can't run a business anymore. I have to work from 16 to 20 hours a day. We don't know what's going on. Professor Gupta, I want to come back to you from that that Economic Policy Institute economist who is saying, you know, when I hear people say I can't find the workers I need, those people should really add at the wages I want to pay. Will you explain where we are with companies' wages, potential employees?
Well, let's just take one state as an example here. So the state of Tennessee has a Jobs for Tennessee portal that workers participating in unemployment benefits use, and it lists about 250,000 jobs throughout the state. One could say, oh, but there's, you know, 50,000 people claiming unemployment benefits in the state, I think, as of a couple of weeks ago. Why aren't they filling the 250,000 jobs that are out there, right? But just if you want to look into what's going on, you look at the wages. And, you know, what share of those 257,000 jobs pay more than $20,000 a year, which is below the poverty line for a family of three?
Wow.
It's just 3%.
Huh.
Just 8,500 of those 257,000 jobs pay more than $20,000 a year. So these are in many cases not livable wages, even with the supports that you might get from the Earned Income Tax Credit or other government programs and policies.
Call from April in Sioux Falls. Hi, April. Good to have you on the line. What's this look like from your perspective?
Well, I've now been 23 years in the same job, working a retail job. And, you know, 20 years ago, it was a great paying job. But now I'm part-time. I own my own business. But I'm still surrounded by the same full-time staff who've been there for 20 years with me. And we're realizing we're having to hire part-timers with no experience who are 20 years old for more than some of the managers are making. And the managers are finally figuring it out and they're bailing left and right.
Huh. Okay, so I understand this. You've been in this at this company for more than 20 years. You went to part-time. They're, when the company is trying to hire new people, they're having to bring them in at salaries or hourly wages that are higher than what you're making?
Yeah, which is, and again, I'm part-time now. I own my own business, and
okay,
I'm in a position where I'm a distributor to that company, and I'm just there to pay off a broken arm loan from 5 years ago our insurance wouldn't cover.
Oh,
so
my
it's
gosh. Wow.
So I'm torn between just, like, I'm crushed because they're my family,
mm-hmm,
and I'm also excited that we're finally sort of starting to fix some of the wages, but it's not catching up the line at all. So we're raising the wages for part-time to get them in the door, but we're not compensating the people who've been there for two and three decades.
Professor Groshen, what's going on with that? I'm sorry, April, did I cut you off? Go ahead.
Oh, I was just, what you were saying, I was like, what's up with that?
Yeah. Okay, Professor Groshen, what is up with that?
Yeah. So this is just a really stark example of the wage stagnation that we've seen, particularly for people without college degrees in this country. While wages for people with a four-year degree have been rising fairly steadily, wages for people without a college degree have been quite stagnant.
Mm.
And this goes along with employers at the same time increasing essentially their requirements for jobs, saying that more a higher and higher proportion of jobs that they hire for require a college degree, to the point that BLS has predicted that 75% of the jobs created in the next 10 years will be in occupations that these days employers say they're requiring a college degree for, when less than half of the workforce has a college degree. Now, there is, you know, there are a number of ways to solve this disconnect, and one of them is to realize that we are, that we seem to be undervaluing the skills developed by experienced workers on the job who don't have a college degree. There are many ways to learn skills, and not all of them are in the classroom, right? And so there are a lot, there actually are a lot of workers who are doing work very successfully in occupations for which employers now only hire people with a college degree for. When someone like the caller wants to change work, sometimes she can't get an equivalent job in another company because they are automatically screening out workers who could do the job but don't have the sheepskin.
Very interesting.
So that's an opportunity gap.
Right.
That's a real problem. It's a it's an information problem, and it's also a bit of a training problem because employers do usually have to do some training for their new employees, but they're not thinking about what kind of training they would need for workers without a college degree but with vast experience that's relevant.
Right. To the phones here to Pam in Hopkins. Hi, Pam. Sounds like what? Are you in the midst of looking for work? What's your situation?
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was laid off in April of 2020, and after the shock wore off of, you know, thinking that I was going to retire at this job, I immediately started looking for a job and haven't quit since. So I was in sales, and I was making a good living. I was doing it for 13 years, and I know that I won't start at what I was making at that particular job. But what I've done is figured out what my minimum is that I can make just to survive in my current life situation. But I'm still finding that employers are paying $20,000 to $25,000 less than what my minimum is just to survive.
Yeah. I mean, but Pam, it sounds like you've got a lot of experience. So when you're coming to these job interviews and you show them 25 to 30 years of experience, what happens? Are you applying for entry level jobs, and that's why the pay is so low?
Well, that's a very good question, and they haven't worded it as entry level. But the one key is that they haven't noted what the salary is going to be, or even what the range is going to be.
Hmm. Do you have a college degree, Pam? Just because of what Professor Groshen was saying, I'm curious.
I do not.
Professor Gupta, I'd really love to hear you follow up on what Professor Groshen was saying about companies, college degrees, screening out people that have the kind of experience that Pam has. What's the effect of that?
I mean, it's a real challenge, and we see this after almost every recession where companies, start adjusting their requirements and skills, even for the same work. And, typically they start increasing requirements because they can have their pick of workers. And but they make all sorts of, complex decisions. But I think, broadly, what's quite striking is, as Professor Groshen noted, the American economy has been one that has not produced benefits for people with less than a college degree, and frankly, modest benefits for people on average with a college degree for about half a century. And when we're asking what's going on, in some ways, maybe we're finally showing some signs of breaking away from those long-term trends that have held back the working and middle class. To be clear, I think that we've yet to see the effects of the American Rescue Plan in full force, and that will take many months and well into next year, including addressing some of the challenges we're talking about. We're talking about that piece of legislation has, you know, the largest investment in childcare since World War II. And we have, the new proposals by the Biden administration, the American Jobs Plan, American Families Plan have, also extraordinary potential. And we haven't really done much more than emergency relief. So if we're talking about people's, training, switching careers, the callers struggling after an extended job search, despite all experience, to match up with an appropriate job that allows her to live, even at a reduced standard of living.
Right.
This takes time. So I think patience is really going to be a virtue, and benefits like unemployment assistance really buy people time. They're not permanent. They're temporary for everyone who gets it. And it's really all about buying people time.
From a listener on Twitter, I can't work more than part-time or I lose my affordable MinCare, which is health insurance. Employer insurance, either not offered or way too expensive. I've turned down jobs with high premiums. To Peter, listening in St. Paul. Good morning, Peter. Thanks so much for waiting.
Good morning.
Hi. What's your observation here?
Yeah, I'm actually a statistician myself. We call us data scientists to make it glossy, but at the end of the day, it's that. helped my parents with assisted living, mm-hmm. and it's a great facility. Yesterday, I walked in the door, and there were signs on the front door that said, walk-in job applications.
Really?
For support. And like I said, it's a great place, but it kind of scared me.
Yeah.
And actually, someone's just knocking on the door now. I'm over there. I'm almost wondering if some of those jobs, I'm wondering if some of those jobs would be better, demarketized, if you will. And I remember the Ventura administration suggesting like almost a conscription type service where we pay for all the schooling, almost like what Norway does with conscription,
mm-hmm.
In order to staff those positions. Maybe it's time to offload that from the market economy because clearly it's not work. And by the way, we're doing independent contracting on the side to augment because we see some effects. Well, it doesn't take long to run the math, and all of a sudden the business model for that whole industry breaks.
Right. Peter, as it happens, we have a caller who is also in the assisted living industry on the line. I hope you can listen to this. I want to hear from John in Brainerd. John, what do you do in the industry? Hi, John, are you there? Oh, he might have stepped away. Okay. So, Professor Groshen, I guess to Peter's concern that, the assisted living industry, which I know is low paying no matter what, is now desperate enough for people that it's just walk in and apply. I mean, I think his concern is what kind of qualifications are they willing to, or lack thereof, willing to forgive for work like this?
Well, one of our problems with all of these kinds of assessments is that we don't have the depth of labor market information that we should have to be able to answer some of the questions you've raised and for employers to make the right decisions. So it can be okay for employers to take walk-in applications. There's nothing wrong with that. The question is, can they then make good decisions about who to hire and how to train those people and how to supervise them? And for that, there's you need experience, but you also need comparable data to help guide good decisions on the part of the assisted living facility so that they know what kind of training other places offer and how well that works for them so that they can do their own internal experiments and learn from experiments that others have done.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been underinvesting in our labor market information data.
Professor,
we could be doing so much better to answer the kinds of questions that the caller raises. Now any answer I give you would be gut, we need more than just guidance.
Understood. I just wanted to ask you, though, it is the case that that is a low-paying industry that is highly needed and I mean, I think you mentioned demography, or one of our callers did, that is going to be ever more needed as America ages.
Absolutely. No, the BLS projections for jobs in that industry are essentially through the roof, right? Because of our aging population. And we know also that the business model for many of these facilities is going to have to change because of things we've learned from the pandemic. And most of those will increase the labor demand for those facilities. So this is, an area that's going to need a lot of attention. The last administration did improve working conditions for many of these workers by expanding coverage to the Fair Labor Standards Act provisions, and that has made the jobs a little more attractive. But they're still low pay and very difficult jobs in many cases.
Call here from Daniel in Minneapolis. Hi, Daniel. I wanted to get you in here under the wire. What's your story?
Hi. Yeah, I have over 25 years of retail management under my belt. And when my wife took a job with one of the biggest employers here in the Twin Cities area, I was forced to go part-time because there's a penalty on her health care. If I have a job that allows me to have access to health care. Between that and the cost of daycare, I figured that I was actually offered a promotion at work just last month, and I had to turn it down because I did the calculations, and I would have been working for about $2.50 an hour between the penalty and the cost of health care.
Jeez. Wow. Boy, what's the solution on the child care there? I mean, besides the kids are growing up.
I guess all intents and purposes, I'm a stay-at-home dad.
Right.
I get out of the house to a couple days a week to work part-time at a local business just to keep my sanity.
Yeah. Boy, Daniel, thanks so much for calling in. Good to have your perspective. You know, Professor Gupta, we've had a lot of conversations about healthcare, a lot. But it is notable here that we've heard from a number of people this morning about how what they pay for health care or their access to affordable health care is affecting their decisions about the jobs they can take and the salaries they can make. What does that say to you?
That's right. Health care in the United States, somewhat uniquely among wealthy countries, is a real challenge for people to hold the jobs they want and pursue the careers they want. As Dr. Groshen mentioned, the Obama administration made enormous progress, but we're quite far from a seamless healthcare and health coverage system that allows people to not worry about it when they think about what sort of work they want to do. The American Rescue Plan did include substantial incentives for those holdout states that haven't expanded Medicaid fully. The incentives are so great that it, in every instance, would actually exceed the cost of expanding coverage,
including Texas.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
That's right. So let's certainly see if the leaders of those states do what's the rational thing and I think the fair thing, expanding Medicaid in their states, or if it's some extreme ideological position that they won't budge from. But we do need to address it if we want workers to do their best work and pursue the careers that are best for them.
Indy Dutta Gupta is the co-executive director of the Center on Poverty and Inequality at Georgetown University. Erica Groshen, on her way to Seattle this summer, is senior economics advisor at the Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations. Thanks also for all of the experience of being in the job market and making the kinds of decisions that you are. Much appreciated. Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., as Derek Chauvin is headed for court for sentencing, we're going to talk about duty to intervene legislation, policies that require officers to intervene in the behavior of another officer. more difficult to execute than they sound. We'll fill you in and we'll take your calls tomorrow at 9.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.